in a reasonable amount of detail, when we get to borderline personality disorder, which is the area where it's best known. It's a good approach if you've got the resources for it. Mm-hmm. What a lot of people don't notice, if you're doing DBT, this is individual therapy weekly, a weekly skills training group, and a consultation group for the therapist.
Yeah.
And if you're not doing those three, you're not doing DBT, according to Marsha Linehan,
right,
who developed it.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's not practical for people in small group practices or solo practice. If you're part of a hospital system, community mental health center, and so on, then it's a question of, will the powers that be give you the budget to do this? It's a good approach if you've got the resources for it. Now, you know, I'm going to be arguing you can accomplish the same stuff with fewer resources in ways that are practical, you know, in agencies and hospitals, but are also practical in small group practices and solo practices. And it seems to me that that's an advantage.
I mean, from the client perspective also, it's not that practical. I mean, I have clients, they just cannot afford.
Right, they can't afford it,
or do they have the
time to do it?
And time, effort means, like, not only economically, also time commitment and all this.
Now, there are also a lot of strengths to DBT, and there are some useful things. You know, Beckian cognitive therapy is a very exclusive approach, and we've stolen interventions from a lot of different approaches. And you're going to see some of Marsha Linehan's handouts when we talk about borderline personality disorder. But first, let's get to today's topics.
So I'll start the sign-in sheet around.
I'll start the handouts around. Any questions, comments, observations? We've just been on one about acceptance and commitment therapy. Anything else before I get rolling on today's content? Yes.
So one of the thing I noticed for the GD is times they have like that worry, anxiety of the week. Every week they have worry. I wanted to hear what's the best way to approach that.
Well, there are a variety of options, but when we get to borderline personality disorder, where they tend to come in with a crisis of the week, you'll hear a different approach which works better with borderline personality disorder. But with generalized anxiety disorder, what we want to focus on is, you know, is worrying about this a good way to handle it? You know, that part of what comes up with GAD is the person approaches life as though if something's important, if something might go wrong, if a problem might happen, then I better worry about it. And they spend a lot of time and energy worrying about whatever they're concerned about this week. So we may well need to address the content of the worry a little bit, but I'm going to focus a lot more on, okay, this is something you're really concerned your kids are going to get involved with drugs. You're really concerned about this outbreak of salmonella. You're really concerned, you know, it sounds like you've been dealing with it by spending a lot of time worrying about it. You know, how useful has this been for you? You know, what drawbacks does it have? Is it important to put your time and energy into worrying about whatever you're concerned about this week? You know, are there alternatives that might be a better idea? And with GAD, you know, often there's a conviction that if something's important, if something might be a problem, if something might go wrong, I should worry about it. Sometimes it's just an abstract sense that one should worry about stuff. I had an attorney client who referred to it as due diligence. You know, that it's as though you have an obligation to worry about whatever concerns you. For other people, this is more concrete. A real common one is, if I worry about it, it won't happen. You know, as though worrying has magical properties that prevents disasters from happening. For other people, the idea is, if I worry about it, I'll be prepared. Or if I worry about it, it won't take me by surprise. And so over the course of working with the person, we're going to want to identify these beliefs and address it. If those things were true, if you know, one line I use with clients a lot is, it would be great if worrying about disasters prevented them from happening. You know, if worrying about cancer prevented cancer, I would sign up for that right away. That would be wonderful. I would very much like to never have cancer. If spending some time worrying about it each day would accomplish that, I would sign up. The bad news is, worrying doesn't prevent cancer. You know, and so you know, I've got a choice, but I could, you know, spend my time worrying and have the same odds of getting cancer as anybody else in my position. I could not worry and have the same odds of getting, or I could come up with a better way to deal with my concerns. And so, a little later, we're going to work on helping the person, you know, one thing Barb talked about is setting as part of what we're dealing with an anxiety disorder, you know, part of dealing with anxiety disorders is helping the person face their fears in manageable chunks and tolerate the anxiety. You know, for most people with GAD, worrying about stuff increases their anxiety. So what do they need to do? They need to put in some chunks of time worrying and tolerating the anxiety. There are also a lot of people with GAD where not worrying about it raises their anxiety, so they need to put in some blocks of time not worrying about it and tolerating the anxiety. And so worry time was one of the big interventions she talked about. But another thing I'm going to get to later in therapy is alternatives to worry. And in a lot of situations, planning and problem solving is a good alternative. You know, the example I use with clients, imagine I'm taking a bunch of Boy Scouts camping. You know, we've got 13-year-old kids in the woods with axes and knives. Gee, there are a lot of things that could go wrong here. I'm responsible. You know, one option I have is I could spend a lot of time worrying about kids chopping off their feet. So, you know, how effective is that going to be for ensuring that the camping trip turns out well? If all I do is worry, this is not going to do anything to preserve the kids' bodies intact. It's just going to have me miserable before the camping trip, and it's going to make it harder to enjoy the camping trip. That doesn't sound like a winning proposition. Should I just not worry about it? That sounds rather dumb. Then we've got 13-year-old kids running around the woods with knives and axes. You know, this sounds like a recipe for disaster. You know, seems like it would be a good move to look realistically at the problem here. Oh, 13-year-old kids in the woods with sharp tools. Maybe before we go camping, we should train the kids how to use this stuff safely. Maybe we should have adequate adult supervision. Maybe we should have a wood shopping area that's separate from the city around the campfire area. Maybe we should have a first aid kit and know how to use it. Maybe we should have our cell phone charged and remember 911. Those things improve the odds of things turning out well. They don't scare me nearly as much. They end up being useful, and it sets things up so we can have a camping trip that's fun and everybody survives. And for a lot of people with GAD, they put a lot of time into worry, oh my God, what if this happens? Oh my God, what if that happens? And they go along to, well, what if it does? What if I get a flat tire? Oh, I can call AAA. You know, what if I have a heart attack? Then I'd better get my butt to the emergency room. You know, that one piece of what goes on with GAD is the concern pops up, oh my God, what if I get, you know, food poisoning from my romaine lettuce? And this scares the person, so they shove the thought away, and they don't think it the rest of the way through. Oh, I'm in ordinary health. The odds are if I get food poisoning from the romaine lettuce, I'll be miserable for a few days and pull through just fine. But I might want to consult my doctor if I'm, you know, feeling real bad. And maybe I should either not buy romaine lettuce or wash it thoroughly. The CDC is saying don't buy it currently. Okay, I'm going to not buy it. You know. And a big part of the problem with GAD is people get as far as, oh my God, what if? And the anxiety is going to come up, so they don't think it the rest of the way through. So what we're shooting for down the road is getting to the point where the person can think it through and also can tolerate some anxiety and uncertainty. If I don't buy romaine lettuce and I buy some other salad green, well, what if that's contaminated? Well, I don't have an absolute guarantee, so I need to sort out how to deal with uncertainty, you know, is another part of the package. How's all that sound? Other questions, comments? Yeah.
Question about the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a last class in June, or did I see that might be a special topic?
July. There's a special topic session in July, which is the final. And the special topic session is different because we do Friday evening and all day Saturday, you know, so as to have more time. And actually, that is a good segue to the announcements, because one of my announcements is you'll be getting a link to the special topic survey, so we can decide what we're going to, you know, what topics we cover are based on what topics you're interested in. So in a few days, you'll be getting a link to a special topic survey. It's to your advantage to fill it out, because that way you get a vote. If you don't vote, then you get stuck with whatever topic other people are interested in. And there's a broad range of topics we can cover. You know, if you can think of a topic, the odds are good that we can cover it. Vote often. No, vote once. Other announcements. Please silence your phones. If you haven't gotten around to turning in your tape for certification or your exam from the first term, no need to panic. All deadlines are flexible. However, you might want to consider whether procrastination is a relevant topic. And how are we going to deal with procrastination? Well, how do we deal with pretty much everything? You know, pick a specific point in time when it's a problem. When have you thought of, you know, recording that session and then ended up not doing it? You know, what was the situation? What were the thoughts and feelings? Okay, let's go through those thoughts and notice which ones are dysfunctional. You know, if you find yourself thinking, I'll do it tomorrow, but then tomorrow you also think, I'll do it tomorrow, and tomorrow never comes, okay, this is dysfunctional. You know, and I might want to, okay, you know, I've got a choice. I can keep putting it off, you know, or I could go ahead and do it. Is it to my advantage to go ahead and get it over with? You know, is there a good reason? Okay, if I'm behind on redoing my readings and listening to the tapes, it probably makes sense to wait until I know what I'm doing before I record a session. If I'm just postponing it because of anxiety, wait a minute, avoidance makes anxiety worse. If I want to be more anxious about recording that session, putting it off as long as possible, it's going to result in my being more anxious. If I would like to be less anxious, then going ahead and getting it over with, I'm going to have to put up with some anxiety. But if I go ahead and get it over with, then I won't be worried about it anymore.
So that's that note, when do we get the feedback back?
As soon as it's ready, Barb is going to have yours for you this afternoon. She's writing it up this morning. So we try to have stuff back within a month. Some months that's more challenging than others. This has been a very busy, stressful month. But we're actually not behind on anything important. Also, you know, just my periodic reminder, don't forget the reading is part of the course. You know, this is not designed so that you can just listen to what we say and skip the reading and learn what you need to learn. You know, what we say in class is based on the assumption that you're doing the reading too. We try not to repeat the text. You know, we try to elaborate on the text. I've also, now that we have some tapes in and have given some people feedback, I've got some comments. These are based some on observations from this year, a lot on observations from previous years. There's a lot of overlap because people are pretty consistent about what challenges they run into. And in random order, one thing is, it's really useful to be clear about what you and the client are trying to accomplish. What are the goals? You know, what are the goals for therapy? And for all of those of you in agency settings where part of the required paperwork is putting down goals, it's important to remember that that may or may not, you know, match what we have in mind in terms of goals for therapy. You know, your agency has their own ideas. Odds are whoever came up with this, you know, is not trained in cognitive therapy. So don't just, you know, Xerox what's in the patient's chart and figure that's done. Is this what you and the client have agreed to work towards accomplishing? There are many agencies where the therapist unilaterally declares what the goals for therapy are. That's not a good basis for a collaborative relationship. If I'm trying to impose my goals on the client, this is probably not going to turn out well. Let's imagine I have a client who's way too compulsive. You know, they're too thorough, too neat, too precise. They need to loosen up. Suppose I approach therapy with the mindset, dude, you need to loosen up and not be so perfectionistic. How's that going to turn out? the client is going to fight me on it tooth and nail, and I'm not going to win that one. You know, in fact, we got some empirical evidence that what usually happens when you do it that way is the client terminates therapy after a session or two. In fact, you know, often the client says, "You're right, doc, that's what I need to do," and then they drop out of therapy. What I need to do is find out what the client wants to get out of therapy. And you remember the way I normally do that is imagine we work together for a while and we're wonderfully successful. How would you like to be different when we're done? If the client gives me a nice, concise list that seems to cover all the important points, it's completely legit for me to just sign on to it. But most clients are going to need some help thinking this through. They may name a few things, and they may not mention, oh, they would like to be less depressed. You know, they came in complaining of depression, but they don't mention that as a goal for therapy. Okay, I say, gee, you also mentioned being really depressed. Would you like to be less depressed? And it's important to talk it over rather than just presuming it. A, I could be wrong in guessing what the client wants. B, if we don't talk it over, the client's going to be reacting as though this is something I'm imposing on them and not registering. Oh, wait a minute, I do want to be less depressed. And particularly, we talked about this with the anxiety disorders, if the client comes in proposing a goal that does not seem like a good idea, I need to talk this through with them and negotiate. You know, for all the people whose goal is, I want to be sure I never have another panic attack. I want to never feel anxious again. I don't sign on to that. That's a counterproductive goal. I need to talk it through and get the client to sign on to something maybe along the lines of, I want to understand my panic attacks and learn how to deal with them so they don't stop me from doing the things I want to be able to do. You know, that's going to be a much, you know, more productive goal to work towards than I want to guarantee I never feel anxious again. You know, and for all the people who come in where their initial goal is, I want to make my husband change. You know, we're going to need to talk to. Is this? There are occasions where coaching a person on behavior change strategies is a fine way to go. If somebody wants to get their 5-year-old to go to bed on time, you know, some parent guidance on how to get your kid to go to bed on time is a fine idea. On the other hand, for all the people who want to change their spouse, want to change their boss, want to change their parent, this probably is going to turn out not to be a productive goal to work towards. And we might want to negotiate something on the lines of figuring out how to deal with this person more effectively. You know, how to not be so upset about the other person being the way they are. You know, sorts of things. You know, with agenda setting, hey, remembering an agenda is a really good move, but also making use of it. Setting an agenda and then ignoring it for the whole session is, you've wasted the 30 or 60 seconds you spent on agenda setting. You know, agendas are only useful if you use them. One thing that comes up, an important point that comes up in some of the outcome studies, is don't do it by rote. Don't just march through the protocol without thinking. You know, you need to accomplish what needs to be accomplished at each stage. So if I try discussing for goals for therapy, we don't actually come up with any goals, and I just move on without any goals, this isn't going to work very well. You know, if we try pinpointing automatic thoughts, and we don't actually pinpoint any thoughts, but I just move on, this is not going to work it out very well. If I try getting the person up off the couch being more active, and they're not yet up off the couch being more active, and I just move on, this does not turn out well. You know, I need to achieve the objective and then move on. So, you know, with depression, you know, I need to get the person being more active, and it may take more than the usual number of sessions with some clients, but I want to accomplish that and then move on to the thoughts, unless it's a really mild depression. You know, and one of the things that comes out in the outcome research is one of the leading reasons for cognitive therapy to end up being ineffective is that at each step people are, you know, giving it a brief try and then moving on without accomplishing what needs to be accomplished. That does not work.
Well, I was just going to ask, you know, I've been trying to use some of these techniques that we're talking about, especially mm-hmm. agenda setting, but I've noticed that with one or two clients, even if they we establish agenda or objectives even for that mm-hmm. specific session, really all they want to do is talk. I want to be sensitive to that too, because if they're telling me, you know, this really makes me feel a little better talking to you, I'm not going to say, well, no, we're not going to. Do you know what I'm saying?
An excellent question. And there are a couple levels to responding to that. You know, as soon as I notice, wait, we set an agenda, but this person just wants to talk, it might be a good idea to, you know, discuss that with the client. Gee, you know, we talked at the beginning about an agenda, but it seems like what you really want to do is just talk about this stuff. You know, am I right about that? A, which gives them an excellent chance to tell me I'm wrong if I'm wrong. You know, for all the clients who just want to talk, they'll say, yeah, actually, just talking about it leaves me feeling a lot better. And I can tell, okay, great, that sounds like, you know, an argument in favor of talking about this stuff. And then I need to think, how do I, you know, get the client to see how it's to their advantage to actually work on stuff rather than just talking? And I might want to circle back to, you know, when we talked about overall goals for therapy, here's what you said you wanted. You know, now, right at the moment, it sounds like you like the idea of just talking about stuff because it leaves you feeling better right now. You know, so one choice, you know, we've got is, do we want to, you know, spend our time doing stuff that has you feeling better for right now but doesn't make any changes in your life? Or do you want to actually make some changes so that your life improves and you feel better? And, you know, a lot of people have the image that you go to therapy, you talk about stuff, you feel better, and that's the way it's supposed to be. Doing therapy that way would be really good for my mortgage payments, because that means every week you need to come in and talk to me in order to feel better for this week, and nothing changes, and you spend the rest of your life coming in and talking to me and feeling better. That's not a bad thing. It's actually better for me than you improving your life and going on without me at some point. But it seems to me like it's not as good for you. You know, if you could come in here, we talk, and we make some changes so that you accomplish the things you want to accomplish, your life is better, and you eventually get to the point where you don't need to come in and talk to them anymore. That's not as good for my mortgage payments, but it seems like it's better for you. And also, we don't need to worry about my mortgage payments because there's no shortage of people with problems. Now, the catch is, if we work on stuff in the hopes of making changes in your life and getting to where things are going better, that doesn't necessarily feel better in the short run. In fact, it often ends up talking about uncomfortable stuff that feels worse in the short run, but ends up paying off and ends up feeling better in the long run. It often involves going forth and doing stuff that feels worse in the short run, but pays off and feels better in the long run. So one option is to just come in, do stuff that feels better in the short run, and not make any changes. Another option is to tolerate some uncomfortable feelings in order to make some changes that improve your life. You know, decent analogy. Suppose I go to the gym and only do what feels good. How well is that going to work for me getting into better shape? You know, if I go into the gym and really work out, I'm going to be hot and sweaty. I'm going to be stiff and sore tomorrow. You know, the stuff that works best in terms of getting in shape might not be the stuff that's the most fun. You know, it would be great if I could just do what was fun and I felt like, and poof, I would be in great shape. But most people find that if they want to be in good shape, they need to do some stuff that's not fun in the short run. Now, if I stick at it long enough to get in decent shape, I may well get to the point where it is fun. You know, and so, you know, I like the idea of using analogies and metaphors and so on to get points across. How's all that sound?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. Just figure out a way to circle back to the, like, why did you come in there in the first place?
Yeah, and a big part of it is keeping clear in my own head, what do I need to accomplish today? You know, part of that is the agenda, and part of that is thinking strategically in terms of what do we need to accomplish in order to get to where we're trying to get to today. And, you know, an impediment that comes up for a lot of people is they're not really thinking about it. They just want to feel better today. You know, for a lot of people, with or without anxiety disorders, it's avoiding unpleasant feelings plays a big role in lots of problems. You know, and so we often need to help people see why it's to their advantage to go ahead and do stuff that's uncomfortable. Other suggestions taken from various people's tapes. When you do pinpoint an automatic thought, write it down word for word. That works a lot better. It makes your job a lot easier. You know, if the client's thought actually was, quote, I never do anything right, unquote, and you paraphrase it as, you felt like a failure. You know, you're making it sound as though your wording is better than theirs. You're making it sound like the wording of the thought as it goes through their head is not important. And you're making your job a lot harder for you. It's going to be a lot harder to get a handle on, you felt like a failure. Then, you know, I never do anything right is an easy target. Let's examine the evidence. What convinces them that they never do anything right? Do they see any evidence that doesn't fit with that? They probably don't. Okay, how did they do it getting to my office today? I'm willing to bet that they did an okay job at getting to my office because they're sitting there in front of me. You know, that right there gives me an interesting, you know, an easy chunk of evidence. You know, and the odds are, it'll turn out, among other things, that they notice all the mistakes they make, and they don't notice all the things they do successfully. And that it's not true that they never do anything right. You know, some things they do wrong over and over again, but lots of things they do just fine. You know, so an exact quote makes your job a lot easier. Also, in responding to thoughts, it's useful to think. If the automatic thought is, quote, why is this happening to me, unquote, and I ask, what's the evidence? Does this make any sense? Is there evidence? Why is this happening? It's a question. You know, and thoughts that are worded in terms of questions are a little harder to get a handle on. You know, a way to make it much easier is, at the moment when this ran through your head, did you have, this is a question, at the moment when it ran through your head, did you have an answer in mind? And if the God, the person, the thought they've told me is, why is this happening to me? And at that moment, they were thinking, well, this is happening because God's punishing me. Okay, that's useful information. And okay, it's a little hard to examine the evidence whether God's punishing them or not. I might want to use a different line of intervention on that one. And, you know, one of the things we talked about at the beginning, but probably haven't emphasized it as often as we need to because people keep forgetting about it, don't overlook the therapeutic relationship. If I'm just throwing techniques at the person, this does not work very well. We need to establish and maintain a good collaborative relationship. We need to notice, you know, problems in the relationship and address them. If we want CBT to work. And if I have to choose between maintaining a good working relationship and techniques, I'm going to go for the relationship. You know, techniques without a good working relationship are ineffective. A good therapeutic relationship by itself actually has a lot of value and does a lot of good. We can get a lot of added value about doing the techniques in addition. But the therapeutic relationship is very important. And we'll be hearing a lot about that in dealing with Axis 2 problems. The final thought in asking for feedback, which is really useful to do on a regular basis, suppose I ask, now that we've discussed this, don't you feel better? Is that asking for feedback? No, that's asking the person to tell me that I did a good job, which is not useful. You know, it's much more useful to say something like, I'm thinking back about how today's session went. Do you see anything you wish was different? Is there anything you'd like us to do differently the next time? That won't feel as good because the person may well point out some room for improvement, but it's a lot more useful. Questions, comments, reactions? Okay, let's move on to personality disorders. An interesting and complex topic. Consider the following situation. I've got a new client scheduled. Never met with her, just talked with her briefly on the phone to schedule the first appointment. I finish with my preceding client, step out to hit the bathroom. My secretary hands me a pink message slip saying that Jane called in tears, crying, saying that she can't make it to her appointment because her husband's beating her up and taking the car. Okay, I go ahead and hit the bathroom because some things are not optional. And then I give Jane a call, and she repeats the story that she can't make it to her appointment because her husband's beating her up and taking the car. And she doesn't want to discuss it in any more detail than that. She doesn't want to make another appointment, saying, quote, "I don't think I'll be able to keep it." Something about her tone prompted me to inquire, and she doesn't mean doesn't think she'll have transportation. She means she does not think she will be alive. She thinks she will have committed suicide before we could have another appointment. Hmm. You know, so I go into suicide intervention mode, and she's not willing to discuss it with me. She's not willing to make a commitment not to kill herself. She's not willing to make a commitment to talk with her psychiatrist. And we go around and around for a little while, and this is not getting anywhere. So, I let her know that, A, killing herself is not a good move. B, I really think it would be a good idea for her to schedule an appointment. C, I think it would be a really good move to talk to her psychiatrist. And then I'm sitting there trying to decide whether to call the rescue squad or not, and realizing, wait a minute, this is a first visit. I don't know her address yet, etc. When her husband calls, sounding all cool and collected, and says he understands Jane missed her appointment today. Do I by any chance have any time available later in the day? It happens I've got an hour free later in the day. He says, we'll take it. They show up together, apparently on good terms with each other. I meet with Jane. We have a perfectly fine initial session. What the heck is going on here? And you get a lot of things like this going on. It's okay, this makes doing effective therapy complex. If I don't even know what the heck is going on, how do I deal with this effectively? And not surprisingly, Jane will turn up next time when we get to borderline personality disorder. But personality disorders are among the most stubborn and most hardest to understand problems that we deal with. And they can be very frustrating to treat. Cognitive therapy is a relatively short-term approach. If it gives us a way to quickly and systematically help people with personality disorders, that would be a great idea. But it's not quite that simple. If you just take a standard cognitive therapy protocol off the shelf and apply it without any adjustments, this does not work very well. For example, Giles Young and Young did a study of a cognitive behavioral protocol for bulimia. Which worked well overall, 76% success rate. Hey, that's a pretty good batting average with bulimia. Of their sample, they had six people who did not respond to treatment, even though everybody else did. Among those six were all the people with borderline personality disorder in their sample. Three-quarters of people in general responded to treatment. None of the borderlines responded to treatment. And back in the early 80s, some people were looking at this literature and concluding that, this shows that you can't use CBT with personality disorders. We need to refer them to analysts or something. Of course, that was the same year that the first papers on CBT with personality disorders were presented. And it turns out, no, it's if you do cognitive therapy for bulimia with borderline personality disorder, this does not work well because, yes, they've got bulimia in addition to the borderline personality. If you just ignore the personality disorder and don't address it, that mucks up treatment. It's just like if somebody has bulimia and a substance abuse problem, can you just ignore their substance abuse and expect therapy to work well? No. When you've got co-occurring disorders, you need to at least consider, do these interact in a way that we need to either address the other problem first or address them concurrently? Treating problems one at a time sometimes works, but often is problematic. Back in the old days, pretty much everybody agreed, personality disorder, complicated, difficult, etc. we need a specialist in town or two who treats personality disorders. We refer everybody to them. And a lot of therapists have been said, I don't treat personality disorders. I refer them on to somebody who does. And that sounds reasonable. It makes sense. One of the things that really caught people's attentions with the DSM-3 field trials, so this was a while ago, you know, when they do a new edition of DSM, they don't just print it up, put it on the bookshelf, and see how it works. They actually test this stuff out in real life practices to see how it goes. And when they were doing the field trials on DSM-3, in DSM-3, the diagnostic criteria for personality disorders were a lot more clear-cut and objective than they had been in DSM-2. And they were amazed to discover that in your average outpatient setting, roughly 50% of the population met criteria for at least one Axis II disorder, which is what personality disorders were called back then. You know, okay, wait a minute. If about half of my caseload has, you know, meets criteria for at least one personality disorder, is it feasible for me to refer all of those people out? You know, it might make my job easier, but no, this is not feasible. You know, whether my goal is to cure the personality disorder or whether my goal is simply to work effectively with people who have a personality disorder in addition to whatever problem I'm working on, it sounds like if I'm in practice, I'm going to need to deal with personality disorders. And so, you know, this is an important topic. It's a challenging one for therapists. It's, you know, a lot more common than many of the problems we talk about. And it has a big impact in the client's life. But it was a little challenging for behaviorists and cognitive behaviorists to get their heads around. First of all, the label personality disorder makes it sound like this person's got a broken personality. What we need to do is fix their personality. And this did not fit real well with the way the behaviorists and cognitive behaviorists looked at things. And also, when behaviorists and cognitive behaviorists first started trying to deal with Axis II disorders, one of the things that happened to be going on in the field at that point is we were in the middle of rejecting the concept of personality, which seems bizarre to a lot of people who you know don't have behavioral backgrounds. Isn't it obvious that personality is important? Different people have different personalities. Isn't it obviously that, you know, this explains a lot of their behavior? Introverted people act different than extroverted people, etc. You know, and so this seems like a dumb idea to a lot of people, but it actually wasn't nearly as dumb as it seems like. First of all, how had the behaviorists gotten to where they were? Well, at that point, this is back in the 70s, and they'd been looking a lot at stimulus response stuff and conditioning, and they'd come up with some very effective treatments based on those principles. And actually, they'd been getting a lot of mileage out of saying to the analysts, wait, we've got evidence that our treatment works, and you don't, na-na-na-na, boo-boo. And so they were real invested in, you know, the evidence they had on the stimulus response level, the conditioning level, so on. And they had a lot of situation-specific concepts to work with. Conditioning is very situation-specific. You know, stimulus response stuff is very situation-specific. With personality disorders, you've got a problem that occurs across a range of settings over time. Wait a minute. How am I going to explain that in stimulus response terms? This is challenging. Now, we've got the concept of generalization. They tried using that when you collect the data and run it through the computer. Generalization does a lousy job of explaining personality disorders. So they were a little stumped on that front. But also, they had a problem with the concept of personality. First, the analysts had been giving them a hard time for a couple decades. But also, at that point, there was quite a bit of evidence, you know, from research looking at the impact of personality on behavior, showing there was a lot of evidence showing that personality actually has very little impact on behavior. Good example, study done back in the early 70s, I think. It's a study of honesty. Most people think, yeah, honesty is a personality, you know, trait. You know, honest people tell the truth, dishonest people lie. Great. So if we collect the data, we'll find that Honest people tell the truth and dishonest people lie, right? Okay, let's get some standard undergrads because they're cheap and easy to do research on. And we'll pass out a paper and pencil measure of honesty and find out who's honest and who isn't. And then the next week, we'll declare a pop quiz, pass it out to everybody. You know, halfway through the quiz, the prof gets called out of the room to answer a long-distance call, because this is back before cell phones, and when long-distance calls were a big deal. We've got a video camera in the ceiling so that we can observe and see who cheats and who doesn't cheat. And then we can crank this through the data and see if it's true that the honest people don't cheat and the dishonest people do cheat. And you collect the data, you crank it through the computer, and it turns out that undergrads cheat when the prof is out of the room, and they don't cheat when the prof is in the room. And our paper and pencil measure of honesty accounts for less than 10% of the variance in cheating. And if it was this one study, big deal. But at that point, there were dozens to hundreds of studies on different personality traits showing that paper and pencil measures of personality accounted for very little in terms of behavior. So the behaviorists were saying, this personality stuff is bullshit. It's great for poets and philosophers, but if you want to be scientific, you need to look at the data, and personality does not hold water. Wait a minute, how do we deal with personality disorders? And I'll just let me mention in the handouts, first of all, on the first page of the handouts, we've got some recommended resources, which are obviously things I recommend taking a look at. So when behaviorists first started trying to figure out how to deal with personality disorders, they looked at DSM and say, okay, maybe it's not a broken personality, but look at that. These people have lots of different problems. Why are personality disorders so complicated and so hard to treat? Maybe it's simply because we're dealing with people who have lots of different problems. If you're treating one problem, that's going to be quicker and easier than if you got a dozen different problems to deal with. Maybe we can just look at personality disorders as a collection of different symptoms and match treatments to symptoms. You know, if you look at the diagnostic criteria for dependent personality disorders, this is somebody who's dependent, they're unassertive, they're uncomfortable with independent decision-making, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, wait a minute. We could do assertion training. We could, you know, address their fears, da-da-da-da. Maybe if we just match treatments to symptoms, it'll take a little while because we got lots of different stuff to accomplish. You know, maybe we can understand personality disorders in that way and treat them in that way. It sounds good. It makes sense. It's logical. It does not work in real life. You know, if you take a person with dependent personality disorder and try doing assertion training, their fear of abandonment freaks them out so much that they never actually try being assertive. If you try addressing their fear of abandonment, it's real hard to do because they're convinced they can't handle life on their own, which makes abandonment real scary. And wait a minute, it's true. They don't have the skills to be assertive. They don't have the skills to balance their own checkbook, etc. But if you try teaching skills, they're afraid to actually develop and use the skills because they're afraid that if they become more capable, then they'll get abandoned. And not only are there lots of different problems, but they interact with each other in ways that make it hard to treat one problem without addressing the others. So just matching symptoms to treatments turns out to actually work very badly. Okay, how are we going to make sense of personality disorders and be helpful? You know, this is about the point where cognitive behavioral folks came on. I'm getting ahead of myself. The second round was, okay, let's go back to the drawing board and look at these diagnostic criteria some more, look at the characteristics of these people some more. Wait a minute, not only do they have lots of different problems, but most of these are problems that occur in an interpersonal context. Maybe it makes sense to look at personality disorders as disorders of social behavior. That doesn't sound like a big step forward conceptually, but it actually turns out to be pretty useful because you've got all these different problems jumbled together. And if we look at it in terms of as disorders of social behavior, that gives a way to organize this stuff. Wait a minute, this person's afraid of abandonment because they don't have the skills to handle life on their own. they're afraid to develop those skills because they're afraid that if they do so, then that will result in them getting abandoned before they're ready to handle life on their own. Okay, how do we deal with that? Maybe by giving a better conceptual framework, then it makes it possible to think in terms of what order to intervene with, how to fine-tune, how to finagle things so as to develop the skills without it freaking the person out too much. This works better. It doesn't work very well. It's still not good enough for us to relax and say, okay, problem solved. But it actually was a noticeable step forward. This is about the point where cognitive behavioral folks came on the scene. And one advantage cognitive behavioral approaches had over the behaviorists, so behaviorists were stuck with mostly situational-specific concepts. In CBT, we had our own situation-specific concepts, like a particular automatic thought occurs on one particular occasion in one particular situation. But we also had some cross-situational concepts, like dysfunctional beliefs. Once you got a dysfunctional belief in your head, it's there in every situation you're in. It may be inactive if it's not relevant to the situation. It kicks in if it's relevant to the situation. I wonder if dysfunctional beliefs could have anything to do with personality disorders. And this was also about the time where schemas became a popular concept in CBT. So, people started thinking in terms of, could personalities be due to dysfunctional schemas? And Jeff Young, in particular, took the ball and ran with it and developed schema-focused cognitive therapy, which then transmuted into schema therapy. And the idea is, once you pick up a schema, it's there, it's persistent, and in each situation where it's relevant, it kicks in and has a big impact. If you have this schema or dysfunctional belief that's only relevant to very limited situations, it's only going to pop up occasionally. If you happen to have one that applies in a lot of different situations, then it's going to pop up and have an impact in lots of situations. Oh, maybe that explains personality disorders. People with personality disorders, this is because they've got dysfunctional schema. And maybe personality disorders are hard to treat because schemas are harder to change than automatic thoughts are. That sounds reasonable. It makes sense until you stop and think, wait a minute. How about my Axis 1 people who just have a unipolar depression or just have a phobia or whatever? Those guys have dysfunctional beliefs. Those guys have problematic schemas too. Why are people with Axis 2 disorders so much harder to treat? And Jeff's solution was, well, people with personality disorders have early maladaptive schemas, and we can capitalize that and refer to them as EMSs. It's, tougher to treat, more complicated, etc., because they're early and they're maladaptive. Wait a minute, my nice clients with unipolar depression and phobias and so on, also, there's dysfunctional beliefs and schemas are generally early and they're generally maladaptive. This does not solve the problem. Well, there are schema coping mechanisms. Having your early maladaptive schemas triggered is aversive, so people develop maneuvers that. And Jeff's path, and a number of other people too, has been to add some more layers onto CBT theory, arguing that the schemas that are involved in Axis 2 problems are different in some way from the schemas involved in Axis 1 problems, and there are all these complex maneuvers that people get into, and some people listening to Jeff's workshops have accused him of rediscovering defense mechanisms and psychoanalytic theory. Jeff once got very mad at me because he thought I was saying that. No, I was saying some people have had this reaction, dude. I'm not saying that's my opinion. But anyway, and it's a plausible way to go. There are a couple of shortcomings. One is, this adds a lot to the complexity of theory. If it's necessary, we need to be however complex we need to be in order to get the desired results. But if there are simpler ways to accomplish the same thing, that's got some major advantages. But also, when people think of personality disorders in terms of dysfunctional schemas, they usually go to the conclusion, so we need to change the person's schemas. And they try identifying and addressing schemas up front early in therapy without paying much attention to specific problems and specific situations and dysfunctional thoughts and so on. And that's got some limitations. Even if we can pull it off, the person's not getting relief on the day-to-day problems they're having, and that's a big issue for a lot of people with access to problems. Also, there's the unspoken assumption that if we change the dysfunctional schemas, poof, all the problems are going to go away, which totally ignores functional autonomy, you know, which we talked about with OCD, that there are a lot of problems where once they develop for whatever reason, they become self-perpetuating and they maintain themselves, they have their own inertia. And so if we just address schemas, you know, there are a variety of shortcomings there. Now, that leaves us okay, so how are we going to make sense of personality disorders in a way that might be a better idea? And if I can get my notes here to cooperate, you know, one thing that's useful is noticing in DSM-4, they came up with a clearer definition of what's meant by a personality disorder. And DSM-4 and now 5 defines a personality disorder as an enduring pattern of inner experience and behavior which is pervasive and inflexible and which leads to distress or impairment. Hey, nothing in that about having a broken personality and needing to fix the personality. Now, you know, we need to find some other way to make sense of why this person has, you know, persistent inflexible problems. And if the looking at personality disorders as disorders of social behavior was useful, and if the idea that dysfunctional beliefs or dysfunctional schemas could play a role is useful, what would happen if we combined those two concepts? You know, one piece of it is, yes, once a person has a dysfunctional schema or a dysfunctional belief, it's with the person, it pops up in relevant situations, it's going to have a big impact. But that's true for everybody. That doesn't distinguish between access 2 problems and access 1 problems. Suppose a person's dysfunctional beliefs influence their behavior in a way that elicits responses from other people that happen to reinforce the behavior. For example, let's take our hypothetical person with dependent personality disorder. They believe they're not capable of handling life on their own. Therefore, they find somebody strong and capable to rely on. And then they're relying on somebody strong and capable to handle stuff. So they're not getting practice at handling things themselves. They're not developing the skills. You know, this relying on somebody strong and capable feels better in the short run, but it perpetuates their inadequacy or their feeling of inadequacy in dealing with day-to-day life. Now, if I need to rely on this person to handle life, then being assertive with them is going to be real scary because I'm going to be afraid that they'll get pissed and abandon me, so I won't be willing to be assertive. You know, it's going to shape my relationship with the person in ways that end up reinforcing my dependency. Among other things, who am I going to end up in a relationship with? You know, if you're out on the dating scene, you go out with a variety of people, and you go on a date with somebody who gloms onto you and wants you to handle everything and take care of them each and every moment, many of us will run away screaming. The people who will say, yeah, sure, are the people who have a strong desire to take care of somebody. And so they're likely to get into a relationship with somebody who has complementary needs. And this improves the odds of it ending up being a relationship that's dysfunctional for both of them. And why is this going to be hard to treat? Well, because the person's day-to-day experience result in a lot of interactions that happen to reinforce the beliefs and assumptions. So, where this leads us is the idea and this is on page 5 in the handouts, the idea that when a person has beliefs and assumptions that shape their behavior in ways that elicit responses from others that then reinforce the beliefs and assumptions, this creates a self-perpetuating cycle, which is likely to be persistent over time and have a broad impact in the person's life. And so this develops the pattern that we then label personality disorder. It's not a matter of broken personality. It's not even something one has. You know, a personality disorder is a label we use for the times when people get into self-perpetuating cognitive interpersonal cycles. And these are difficult to intervene in because they've been going on for a long time. They're ingrained, but in particular, because the way the person is conducting themselves in life produces experiences which reinforce the dysfunctional beliefs. So this can be both strongly self-perpetuating and challenging to intervene in. How's that sound so far?
How much insight does that person have into any of that?
Usually none. Because if they had insight into it, they probably would find themselves thinking, wait a minute, this is a really good idea. You know, what can I do about this? And they might actually eventually muddle their way out of it. It's not quick and easy to figure stuff out when you're in the middle of it. But for, you know, sticking with our example of dependent personality disorder, which we'll get back to either next time or the time after that, is the person is convinced that they can't handle life on their own and they need somebody strong and capable to rely on. Relying on somebody strong and capable feels a lot better than trying to handle life on their own. And they don't notice that this reinforces their dependency and perpetuates it. They're solving their dilemma in the best way they can see. They just haven't spotted the better solutions.
So personality disorder is a learned behavior?
Well, it depends on what you mean by learned behavior. You know, beliefs and assumptions, where do they come from? They come from experience.
Mm-hmm.
Where do our interpersonal strategies come? Well, a big part of it is, you know, the examples we grow up with, what we're taught in the course of growing up, trial and error. So there's a lot of, you know, learning involved in the process. But it's not learned behavior in the sense that I'm taught how to be borderline. It's I learn an assortment of things which then happen to interact in themselves in a way that results in me having compulsive personality disorder or borderline personality disorder or dependent personality disorder. And, you know, with most of the things we learn, there's a variety of ways to learn them. You know, how do I learn to play the guitar? Well, I could take guitar lessons. I could observe people who play the guitar. I could buy a guitar and fiddle around with it for a long time. I could do some combination of the above. So it wouldn't be terribly surprising if a person could learn the things that need to be learned in order to develop borderline personality disorder or dependent personality disorder or whatever. It wouldn't be terribly surprising if a person could learn that in more than one way. At this point, let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll go to a concrete example. Because this has been pretty abstract and conceptual so far, I think it'll be a lot clearer when we take one particular personality disorder and work through the details.